The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
It's my privilege to open this series of Wednesday chapels on the Psalms. The Psalms, which were the hymn book of the Old Testament people of God, speaks powerfully to us and becomes our song of praise to God as well. Since this is the opening sermon on the Psalms, let me give you my two favorite quotes on the Psalms. They're from my two favorite reformers, Luther and Calvin. And in both instances, these reformers speak poetically of the Psalms and give us helpful orientation to the book as a whole. The first comes from Martin Luther, and it illustrates the tremendous variety that we discover in the Psalms and previews the tremendous variety which you will encounter in this series on the Psalms. Luther said, "In the Psalms we look into the heart of all the saints, and we seem to gaze into fair pleasure gardens, into heaven itself indeed, where blooms and sweet, refreshing, gladdening flowers of holy and happy thoughts about God and all his benefits." Talking about the variety of the garden, the variety of the Psalter. I should mention, especially in the light of the last few verses of Psalm 139, Bruce Waltke reacted to that quote by saying, "Yeah, but there are a few rocks in that garden as well." And then there's the quote from John Calvin. John Calvin, who if I gave the full quote, you would notice, reluctantly describes the emotional arousal of the Psalms. But he says, "What various and resplendent riches are contained in this treasury. It were difficult to find words to describe. I have been wont to call this book, not inappropriately, an anatomy of all parts of the soul. For there is not an emotion of which anyone can be conscious that is not here represented as in a mirror." Now, let me add one more image, and that is the image of the Psalms as a literary sanctuary. A literary sanctuary which is parallel to the sanctuary which occupied the center of Israel's religious activities. As you know, during the Old Testament time period, unlike now, men and women could not meet God just anywhere. God was present in a special way in places like the tabernacle or later the temple. It was there that the devout would go to encounter God in an intimate and personal way. The Psalms were used as the setting of the temple, and thus share that intimate, dialogical, personal character between God and the worshiper. And as Doug read Psalm 139, I think we're immediately struck by the intensely personal nature of the psalmist's prayer to the Lord. It is as if we are sneaking up behind him and hearing him pray without him knowing it. In this way, the Psalms are models to us of prayer, and we should pay close attention to them as close attention to the manner in which he prays as we do to the content of his prayer, because both are rich. The first thing that we notice about this prayer, Psalm 139, as we will see is true of all the prayers of the Psalms, and that is the psalmist's brutal honesty. The psalmist, especially in 139, has a clear view of God's omniscience and omnipresence, and he brings those doctrines to bear upon his prayer life. In other words, he knows that no matter how hard he tries, he can't hide anything from God, not even his darker emotions, And so why should he try? He brings them out and speaks to God with a kind of brutal honesty, which I think many of us lack in our prayer life. And as we turn to 139, one more sort of preliminary statement before we actually look at the different parts of the psalm. Let me say that the title given to this sermon doesn't really get to the heart of the psalm. That is a psalm of our birth. The psalm does indeed claim that God is the God of birth, but that's not the setting of the psalm. The best hypothesis concerning the psalm's original setting is that it is a legal setting. That is, this psalm is apparently the psalmist's response to false charges leveled at him by wicked people who want to harm him. This interpretation is gleaned by looking at the last two stanzas of the psalm, verses which are often glossed over in our devotional reading of the psalm. Psalm 139 may be one of the most romanticized psalms of the lot. We tend to read it as an expression of wide-mouthed awe and appreciation expressed with a calm spirit. But throughout, as we go through the psalm, we'll see that this is only a partial truth. Now, as we look at the psalm together, we're going to divide the sermon into four parts following the fourfold structure of the psalm. And as I go to each section, I'll reread the verses which are relevant. And we're going to start with verses 1, 1 through 6. O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out, my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. You hem me in, behind and before. You have laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Here we see in the first stanza of the psalm that God knows me intimately. Now, if we were in a systematic theology classroom, we would discuss these verses under the subject heading of God's omniscience, the truth that God knows everything. And this would be appropriate because that's what this passage teaches. And the book of Psalms is a highly theological book. Athanasius rightly called the Psalms a microcosm of the Old Testament. Luther said that the Psalms were, quote, a little Bible and a summary of the Old Testament, end of quote. But we do well to approach the Psalms as a whole, in Psalm 139 in particular, by heeding C.S. Lewis when he says, quote, the Psalms are poems, and poems intended to be sung, not doctrinal treatises, not even sermons, end of quote. We can see here that the teaching that God knows everything is expressed in an intensely personal way. God knows everything, that is, he knows everything about me. And that's a staggering thought. But it's also a thought about which the psalmist feels ambivalence. His first reaction can best be described as ambivalent. He says, you hem me in. The verb tsir here is usually a negative verb in regard to the direct object, meaning to enclose, to besiege, to barricade, oppress, press hard. A modern slang equivalent may be, you cramp my style. And indeed, God does cramp our style as we imagine him watching our every move, even when we're alone, listening to our every thought. Here's an illustration. You're walking down the hall here in Van Til, and you spot that professor. That professor who gave you a C+ last semester, when you know that you deserved at least a B-, if not a B+. Let me contextualize this before applying it to my colleagues here. You're walking down the hall and you see that student. That student, and you're rushing from one meeting to another meeting, and you're dying to get back to your word processor so you can finish that article which was due 6 months ago, and then maybe spend a little time with your family. And you see that student who thinks that, or you perceive him as thinking that all you have to do between class time is to talk, and had just complained to the dean about how cold the community is around here. Now, in both cases, we're apt, and I'm not saying this is inappropriate, to smile and say hello and to talk. But as we may be boiling within, we must know that, according to Psalm 139, God knows our every thought. And that fact can be, as it was, I believe, to the psalmist, unsettling. But also, as it was to the psalmist, it is ultimately awe-inspiring, and in the final analysis, it's comforting. It was comforting to the psalmist, who, as I said at the beginning, uttered this prayer in the context of official accusations of wrongdoing against him, charges that he knew were false, but it's comforting to him because he knows these charges are false and he knows God knows that they're false. He says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart." Second, verses 7 through 12. "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you." Here in these verses, we learn that God knows us wherever we go, because God is everywhere throughout his creation. The psalmist here explores God's pervasive personal presence throughout the universe. Once again, using systematic theological terminology, we're talking about God's omnipresence. He is everywhere. Through a series of merisms, the psalmist tells us this. He's in heaven. He's also in Sheol, the grave. He's on the wings of the dawn, which are the far east, as well as the far side of the sea, the Mediterranean, meaning the far west. God is there, and this is not some abstract truth. This is a truth which makes a personal impact on him. But once again, I would suggest that the psalmist feels ambivalence about this great truth. He begins with the question, "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence?" He imagines himself trying to get away from God and realizes that he can't. Now, as I read these verses, it reminds me of Jonah. God calls Jonah to a task that he finds particularly distasteful: evangelism. And not just any evangelism, but evangelism of the city of Nineveh, the heartland of the Assyrian oppressor. Now, unlike us, his fear of evangelism isn't a fear of reprisal or embarrassment. His is a fear that the Assyrians might actually listen and repent. That is, repent and be spared of the judgment that Jonah and presumably all of Israel were looking forward to with great anticipation. So Jonah becomes a living historical illustration of Psalm 139, 7 through 12, an illustration which is both the height of biblical comedy as well as tragic. God tells him to go to Nineveh, which is to the east. He heads without a word to the west, boards a ship, and sets out into the sea. But to no avail, you see, because God is present on the sea. And you got to read Jonah in the light of the fact of the biblical imagery borrowed from the broader Near East, that in Near Eastern mythology, the creator God and the sea god are at odds, and particularly the creatures, the monsters of the sea, are in mortal conflict with the Creator God. But here, God is the one who is in charge of all of his creation, including the sea and the great fish within it. So he uses the great fish to serve his purpose and deliver Jonah up on the seashore to fulfill his task. The sea and its monsters are not even a place to flee God's presence. Now, God's omnipresence may be a source of real terror, as it was to Jonah, because, you see, God can hunt you down anywhere. Amos 9, 1 through 4. Strike the tops of the pillars so that the thresholds shake. Bring them down on the heads of all the people. Those who are left I will kill with the sword. Not one will get away. None will escape, though they dig down to the depths of the grave. From there my hand will take them. Though they climb up to the heavens, from there I will bring them down. Though they hide themselves on top of Carmel, there I will hunt them down and seize them. Though they hide from me at the bottom of the sea, there I will command the serpent to bite them. Though they are driven into exile by their enemies, there I will command the sword to slay them. I will fix my eyes upon them for evil and not for good. Or God's omnipresence may be the greatest blessing. In other words, his people know that no matter how much trouble they are in and no matter where they are, their God can save them because he is everywhere. And remind yourselves that, once again, that the Old Testament time period was different than today in terms of conception of God's presence. It was a revolutionary idea that God would be with them in Babylon during the exile, for instance. The idea of a universal God who was everywhere was preposterous in the ancient Near East. Okay, in the third part of our psalm, we see that not only is God all-seeing, not only is he all-present, but he is also all-creative. For you created my inmost being, you knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful, I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. And once again, notice the intensely personal application of this truth that God is the creator. He's the creator of the universe. He's the creator of me. The psalmist realizes that his birth was no accident, and so his life is no accident either. As Samuel Terrian puts it, quote, "The psalmist gives us an expression of a certainty, neither modest nor arrogant, of having been brought into existence for a mission which fits into God's grand plan." To the psalmist, what's important about God's creation of him is that he has meaning in life. He's not lost in a sea of chance, but rather he's on a mission. And this is what leads him to the expression of awe in God's incomprehensible nature in verses 17 and 18. "How precious to me are your thoughts, O God! How vast is the sum of them! Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I am awake, I am still with you." As I mentioned, the psalmist utters these lines of trust in God in the midst of a very difficult situation. He is besieged by wrongdoers, and thus ends the psalm with a hard-hitting imprecation or curse. "If only you would slay the wicked, O God, away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies." Now, if we ran into a non-Christian whom we secretly hated, I would guess that we would probably try to hide that fact from the people around us, but often I think we would try to repress that fact from God. But certainly we would feel guilty about it. Not so the psalmist. The psalmist feels anything but guilt, as he wears it almost as a sign of piety. How can we understand this? Well, I think we must understand the imprecations of the Psalms along the lines suggested to us by the development of the theme of holy war in the Bible. In the Old Testament, God leads Israel in war against the flesh and blood enemies like the Philistines and the Canaanites. These wars, if seen in the context of the whole canon, are previews of the final judgment. In any case, the psalmist does not stop with the imprecation. He turns the divine spotlight on himself, verses 23 and 24. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. The psalmist calls on God to search him. He calls on God to examine him and let him know if there is anything offensive in him. And with that, the psalm concludes. There is silence. And this silence should be understood as a time of listening. The psalmist has spoken. He's made his request to God, and now he listens for an answer. Thus ends Psalm 139, a psalm which presents us with a powerful picture of a God who is all-knowing, in stanza 1, all-present, all-creative, and in the light of the imprecations, he is all-holy. But how do we read this psalm as a Christian? After all, Jesus in Luke 24 said that the scriptures, and specifically he said the law, the prophets, and the psalms, all anticipate his coming suffering and glorification. They're not just a handful of messianic psalms. There are 150 psalms which look forward to the coming suffering and glorification of Christ. And as I meditate upon Psalm 139, I found most productive meditating upon it as a psalm prayed to Jesus, a song sung to him. When we think of Christ as the one who is all present, that is, he rent the veil of the temple at the time of his death, we realize that his omnipresence may be experienced in an intensely personal way anywhere, outside the temple, outside the church, outside the seminary. Secondly, we're not afraid when we hear that Jesus Christ knows our every thought. He knows our every sin. But according to Hebrews, he understands us. He understands our temptations, and he died on the cross for those sins. We also know that Jesus is all creative. He was the firstborn of creation and at the Father's side during the creative process. And we also know that he's all holy and that he now leads us in a heightened and more intense holy war against Satan himself. A war which he won on the cross and a war which he will complete when he appears at the head of the heavenly army to once and for all destroy all evil in heaven and earth. Thus, for the Christian, Psalm 139 is a prayer to Jesus Christ, the all-knowing, the all-holy, the all-present, the all-creative. And like the psalmist, we should end our prayer in the silence which awaits and expects a divine response.